Hello, guten Tag. Let me say right at the beginning that I'm going to be speaking in English, of course, but if you have questions and you'd rather ask me in German at the end, that's fine. I'll be happy to translate it and then answer in English then. Also, I'll be showing some slides, but I'm not going to be speaking too much directly to the slides. I'm just going to have accompaniment, more or less. If I were to speak about the slides, I would talk at least an hour, and I don't want to do that. Okay, why preserve computer games? The conventional arguments cite statistics that measure commercial success. They suggest that computer games, the web, and other new media are displacing television and movie going, particularly among children, teenagers, and older adults. But profits and popularity are not the only reasons for taking computer games seriously. Scholars are also taking note. The bibliography of game studies is growing rapidly, fed by research in literary, media, and cultural studies, the social sciences, even history, I'm a historian, and of course, game design. The Digital Games Research Association in Europe and the North American Simulation and Gaming Association, ASAGA, online research journals such as Game Studies and the International Journal of Intelligent Games and Simulation. In the United States, teaching and research programs at MIT, Carnegie Mellon University, Georgia Tech, and the University of Southern California, to name but a few, all testify to growing scholarly interest in the study of games and related interactive media. Research on the social and cultural impacts of interactive entertainment is replacing dismissal of computer games and video games as mindless amusement for young boys. Today's conference, I suppose, is a little bit more about technology in many ways. I want to talk a little bit now about computer games as art and how that might affect our thinking a bit. The impact of computer games on artistic practice is another piece of evidence for their cultural importance. Debating the status of games as artistic works, however, is less interesting than observing the interplay of computer games and artistic expression. Consider that technologies and practice emerge, consider that technologies and practices emerging from computer games have defined a new space for high-performance play as players express themselves through merged performances of technology, gameplay, and storytelling. Whoops. It's the Ill Clan. My research on the early history of machinima, animated movies made with computer game software, has convinced me that high-performance play is capable of transforming artistic practice, and it altered my thinking about archives of game software as well, particularly with respect to the importance of recording and preserving gameplay, not just game software. In Performer Else, John McKenzie, who's a performance studies scholar, challenges performance studies to consider performance in a wider context. He says, Performer Else initiates a challenge, one that links the performances of artists and activists with those of workers and executives, as well as computers and missile systems. And later he adds, if performance is in our mist, our mad atmosphere, it's also capable of becoming stratified, of leaving an historical sediment of effects that we can read in both words and actions. So, historians and archaeologists of new artistic and performance media, whether games, machinima, remix culture, poetry slams, hypertext literature, will dig for traces of use and performance in this sediment if we can find some way to preserve it. So how do we ensure that future scholars will be able to play history with games? We will need to build and maintain collections of artifacts, media, and software. I'll organize my thoughts about this huge task around three themes. One, what characteristics of computer games as a medium and as software present special challenges? Two, how will these characteristics define the nature of historical software archives, and who will be the curators of these archives, of these collections? And three, a little bit on what we're doing now at Stanford and other institutions to lay a foundation for computer game archives. Now, I'm calling several forms of interactive entertainment computer games. The term video game, of course, usually one word, is often used in much the same way. Video games, more specifically, are games played on devices with video displays, such as televisions or arcade consoles, just as computer games can be limited to shared or personal computers. Nomenclature aside, it's important to comprehend this diversity of formats. Games have been distributed or published as software and game cartridges, operated by depositing coins in machines, hardwired into the circuitry of electronic devices, or downloaded and played entirely over computer networks. The machines or platforms for these games include computers, arcade consoles, television consoles connected to home television sets, handheld game machines, PDAs, mobile telephones, simulators, and networks. Newer forms, known variously as ubiquitous, immersive, or pervasive gaming, use mobile and embedded technologies, mixed realities, and are often location-specific. So I'll speak of computer games as a single medium, but preservation strategies must be tuned to particular modes and machines of play. Well, computer games are software. Since the 1970s, the emancipation of software from big computing has led to our cultural dependence on computers. Doug Engelbart, Ted Nelson, Alan Kay, and others created the possibility of new digital media in the 1960s and 1970s by reconceiving the computer as a communication machine rather than a calculation engine. Convergences of media and technology have since pushed software into nearly every medium of entertainment, art, recreation, and storytelling. Software has become a condition of our lives. Culture is embedded in the computer as much as the computer is embedded in culture. Mark Weiser, who gave us the notion of ubiquitous computing, has remarked that the most profound technologies are those that disappear. They weave themselves into the fabric of everyday life until they are indistinguishable from it. Our personal intimacy with information technology has reshaped its history as being our own history. Oops. So this is our early history, and I only mention this right here because I want to point out the very important problem of preserving the early history of game software, not just the more recent games, but also games that were done in universities and so on in the 1960s and 70s. Computer games are software, but as we have seen, not all games are played on computers in the conventional sense. The first game consoles, Nolan Bushnell and Al Alcorn's Pong and the coin-operated arcade, and Ralph Baer's Brown Box, which would bring the game console into the living room, were products of television technology. While most console games since then have been digital and software-based, it is important to respect the daunting variance in the physical objects encountered by the game archivist. Source code or packaged software for computer games, circuit boards and ROMs for arcade systems, proprietary cartridge designs for console systems, and so on. We should always differentiate physical objects, the code underlying the game, and the conceptual object, what is perceived by the player. The same game code may be carried on different physical media so that similar game experiences, even the same game title itself, are delivered via different code or physical objects. In the archives, different configurations of emulators, restored machines, or museum pieces may deliver quite similar experiences. The relationship between hardware code and context will help applications of emulation and bit-perfect replication of software, but even more important, they will fundamentally affect decisions, curatorial decisions, about retention of objects and the design of metadata schemes to describe them. As software, computer games can be modified. Unlike most other software applications, however, game content is usually packaged together with the game engine, rather than existing separately as documents or files, as in Word documents would be separate from the software. Thus, when we use a game engine to create a new game, we're modifying the game software. Lev Manovich has called this the new cultural economy of game design, which he traces to the release of id Software's Doom in 1993. I prefer to call it the Half-Life economy because I think that's really with Half-Life and Counter-Strike where you began to see the proliferation of this. A published computer game today is often a set of design tools as much as a finished design. With the increasing popularity of modified games, mods, it can be said that game developers ship game engines accompanied by their own levels and maps. Independent level, scenario, and mod designers then take over, sometimes creating entirely new games. These are total conversion mods. Manavich contrasts modifiable games to the more traditional characteristics of a game like Myst, for example, more similar to a traditional artwork than to a piece of software, something to behold and admire rather than to take apart and modify. So those are two different paradigms. Myst is sort of the conventional artistic object. The mod games is something that you can change. Counter-Strike, the most popular internet-based game of all, is a multiplayer modification of single-player Half-Life, demonstrating how mainstream the mod economy of game design has become. Games such as Counter-Strike often exist in countless variants, comprising versions of the original game, Half-Life, versions of the mod itself, patches, other player mods, such as the World War II game Day of Defeat, which is based on Counter-Strike, and so on. The contemporary game scene has been enriched by these creative projects, which range from skinning characters, working up freeware utilities, changing art assets, all the way to creating new games or using game engines to produce movies. With the addition of hard drives and network connections to console boxes, we may soon expect modded games to appear regularly on consoles as well. Capturing the history of community-generated content and the mod scene will require special attention to the variability and modifiability of software, including provisions for carefully documenting version history through metadata. Games are also technology. Game developers often push the technological envelopes of their hardware. 3D graphics and visual effects in games have at times created new markets for PC peripherals such as video cards. Sturdy technical requirements are one aspect of a problem for game preservation. The degree to which specific hardware configurations, display, controller, responsiveness of network or storage components, etc., alters the experience of gameplay is equally important. Recapitulating the technical debate concerning the relative merits of emulation, migration, documentation-based reconstruction, and hardware conservation strategies would easily use up the rest of the conference if I started on that track. Instead, let me quickly emphasize the main point from a curatorial perspective. Simply put, there's a difference between preserving game technology and preserving game content, which includes gameplay. Question: is it necessary to play The Legend of Zelda on the original Nintendo Entertainment System with the original Nintendo controller and a contemporary television set in order to gain a historically valid experience of the game? Well, the experience of viewing the movie Birth of a Nation in a palatial theater with live music and so on is different from viewing it on videotape on television at home. We know that. And so is reading any rare book in a modern edition or another format. Different, yes, but is that difference essential for scholarly research or for any other kind of appreciation of the original game? Can we agree that the most important artifact is usually an accurately documented version of original content, whether in fact in the original format or reformatted? Notice that I'm avoiding the word always here. Access to original artifacts is occasionally essential, sometimes for their historical value, but also an occasion for evidentiary value in another context, say in a patent dispute or something like that. If we focus on content, careful emulation of original hardware will be an indispensable part of the solution for game preservation. By careful, I mean not only that emulators should be able to run original code, but also that they should encompass as much knowledge of the original hardware as possible. For example, absolute precision with regard to timing issues may require emulators down to the level of microcode. And oddly enough, I found out after writing this that somebody was working on exactly that. We may also need to give more attention to devices that emulate physical artifacts, such as controllers or dance pads. This is an area I know of almost no work being done in. You know, Dance Dance Revolution, is anybody working on an emulator that will make sure that people can play that game? Oh, we'll get the questions later. The deterioration of original media means that game software will eventually be available only in reformatted versions. Compliments to CAPS. Emulation and reformatting are two sides of the same coin. The Classic Amiga Preservation Society has precisely defined acceptable versions of game software, not a cracked or hacked version, not a budget version, not a re-release, because these hacks may eliminate game screens or elements of gameplay. The CAPS website, which I recommend to you, admirably summarizes the complex subjects of copy protection, disk duplication, data integrity deterioration, flaky bits, and so on, all of this bearing on the bit-perfect replication of software. The work of building emulators and compiling collections of reformatted software will still require us to keep old machines running for quite some time, even if only to understand important elements of authenticity in the emulators. Okay, last in this section, games are also performance. In the study of games, 1971, Elliot Avedon and Brian Sutton Smith asked, what are games? Are they things in the sense of artifacts? Are they behavioral models or simulations of social situations? Are they vestiges of ancient rituals or magical rites? Avedon and Sutton Smith were leading their readers to ponder structural similarities among games, but their question also asks whether games are artifacts or activities. Are games more like authored texts, or are they experiences expressed through interaction, competition, or play? Computer games provide an opportunity to study interactivity. As we preserve interactive media, we must not lose sight of how we will document interactivity, which means capturing traces of activity, that is, gameplay. The active performative aspect of games provides a special challenge for documentation strategies. As a thought experiment, think for a moment about the case of a game like basketball. Okay? Sorry, I should have chosen football, but I chose basketball. Let's try to choose between texts, artifacts, or records of performance. Do any of these sources tell us everything about the nature of the game? So James Naismith's 13 Rules of Basketball, in a sense, are the source code for basketball. Okay? It's an archival document in this case. We also have artifacts like big stadiums and things like that, but then we also have documents of performance, in this case recordings. Do any of these alone tell us everything we want to know about basketball? Computer and video games are both dynamic and interactive. They're dynamic because each instance of gameplay results in a different set of activities and experiences. The text is never the same. The interactivity of games is the sine qua non of this new medium. Without it, computer games would lose their identity. This will take a second. So gameplay encompasses performance in more than one sense of the word. It encompasses performance as mastery of technology, performance as success in perfecting the skills needed to win the game, and performance as public exhibition. The early history of machinima illustrates all three modes of performance. Machinima makers appropriated game technology to create movies based on gameplay. In other words, technology became a field of play, not just in order to play the game of optimizing game performance, but by redefining the game as a technology for making movies. Machinima subverted the game system, turning it into performance technology. Just as important, machinima drew upon a strong social network spawned by multiplayer gaming. Knowledge of the capabilities built into Quake and access to independently developed tools disseminated rapidly in the virtual community of Quake players. Even before Quake, the intensity and rapid action of Doom's multiplayer deathmatch established a performer-spectator relationship. Doom required skills. Star players emerged, and everyone wanted to see them play, to gather insights into their play tactics, and possibly to learn a trick or two. As Batko, a veteran of the Doom demo scene, points out, A new player who wants to get better requests that a game, this is a quote from some time ago, a new player who wants to get better requests that a game with a higher skilled player be recorded. And then the new player, I'll give you a preview. A new player who wants to get better requests that a game with a higher skilled player be recorded. And then the new player watches the demo, where presumably he lost, from the higher skilled player's point of view, hoping to learn ways to improve his own skill. Demo movies made it possible to see gameplay through another player's eyes. As performances, they also certified the status of star players. Beginning in 1994, the Doom Honorific Title Program, and does anybody have a DHT ranking of any sort? Doom Honorific Title in here? Okay, I always ask. Became the means by which good players can objectively prove to the world that they are as good as they claim. The certification process explicitly promoted the performance of gameplay through demo movies. Years later, the surviving demo movies put viewers in the shell of the ghosts of players. One of the best surviving series, for example, features perfect reproductions of matches recorded as early as May 1995. These recordings allow us to look through the eyes of one of the first game gods, No Skill, having been preserved on the memorial site of this now deceased player. Oops. So those are his game movie recordings. Archives of computer game history must locate, save, and preserve vestiges of gameplay and performance, whether demo movies, speedruns, replays, or machinima, both as original game files and in portable movie formats. A little bit about curatorial models before I get to projects underway. Curatorship of interactive digital media collections confronts the growing volume and diversity of impermanent software. Even collection, preservation, and presentation of historical software requires more software. Software diverges from print or museum culture not just in the impermanence of its media, but also in the flexibility of their use. Software converges previously separated realms: texts, stories, audiovisual experiences, interactive simulations, data processing, records management, and metadata applications such as indexing among them. Who should be responsible for the custodial care of software and new media collections? Traditional institutions and professional identities provide uncertain guidance. Let's listen for a second to Doran Swade, who's a museum curator, head of a major museum in Great Britain. Oops. Some software is already bespoke. Archivists and librarians have owned certain categories of electronic document, digitized source material, catalogs, indexes, and dictionaries, for example. But what are the responsibilities of a museum curator? Unless existing custodial protection can be extended to include software, the first step towards systematic acquisition will have faltered, and a justification for special provision will need to be articulated ab initio in much the same way as film and sound archives emerged as distinct organizational entities outside the object-centered museum. Swade calls this the problem of preserving information in an object-centered culture. Libraries are coming to grips with related issues that might be described as preserving information in a text-centered culture. Software creates a relationship between media objects and their content that no longer privileges the original artifact. Current debates about the best methods for preserving software turn to some degree on institutional and professional allegiances to the conservation of objects. Games and other interactive multimedia need new models of curatorship and collections. So far, we have many, many ideas about this. An example, Jürgen Klaus, who's a professor of media art at the Kunsthochschule für Medien in Cologne, noted the expansion of media art way back in 1985 and asked, what will remain of the electronic age? He reasoned that we have to ask for adequate spaces to display and store this art, that is, we have to ask for media museums. He said that a media museum that the museum must not be relieved of its duty of being a place of reference for works of remaining value. Certainly, film, photography, video, disc, tape, etc., are media to store events of art. Where should they be collected, examined, and passed on, if not in an adequate museum, that is, a media museum? Another example, the History of Computing Committee of the American Federation of Information Processing Societies, AFIPS, about 15 years ago, said, if we are to fully understand the process of computer and computing development as well as the end results, it's imperative that the following material be preserved: correspondence, working papers, unpublished reports, obsolete manuals, key program listings used to debug and improve important software, hardware and componentry engineering drawings, financial records, and associate documents, and last, artifacts. In short, this new media repository, this second idea, is a historical archives. Now, an Australian librarian named Boyd Raymond has written about this convergence of different models. He says that the functional differentiation of libraries, museums, and archives, as reflected in different institutional practices, different physical locations, and so on, is actually relatively new. According to him, the scholars never stopped favoring the ideal of a personal cabinet of curiosities tuned to the subject matter of interest to them. This ideal considers formats of artifacts and media as irrelevant. It stresses content. He asks us to reconsider this undifferentiated past, as he calls it. I submit that computer game archives as cabinets of new media curiosities will provide a good test for this idea. We will play history with games in a librarium, which is a library archives museum, that unites digital libraries, software archives, and media museums. Okay, so let me finish up now by talking about a couple of projects. Whoops. About a year and a half ago, we had a conference in Stanford. Andreas was there. We talked about, in a paper that I gave there, I talked about what I thought some of the goals should be for the next few years, some nice ideas about what we could do. And I won't do that now. What I'll do is just give a couple of examples of some things that have happened since then that address maybe these goals. The first is the Machinima Archive, which, when I wrote this text a week and a half ago, was something that would be launched later this summer. And just before getting on the plane, I just took a look because I wanted to download this. This isn't actually the live page. This is something I downloaded in case I didn't have an internet connection. And it was up. So the Machinima Archive is already up. Not fully, I guess. It's sort of a quiet launch, and there'll be a full launch later. This was put together by a collaboration of interested parties, and it's hosted by the Internet Archive. Thank you, Simon. It will be launched for public access. It has been launched. The collaboration partners are the Internet Archive, the How They Got Game Research Project at Stanford University, which I'm co-director of, the Academy of Machinima Arts and Sciences, and machinima.com. This collection will secure a significant body of game performance. The inaugural collection includes early works such as Diary of a Camper, an early speedrun from the Quake Done Quick project, movies from the Ill Clan, Jake Hughes, and Strange Company, to name only a few titles and artists. In fact, the entire machinima.com collection will eventually be on there. The primary archival format, from my point of view, will be the original game data files, since many Machinima movies, particularly early efforts, were intended to be seen within the games themselves. So you ran Quake, you ran the movie inside Quake. Following the established practice of the Internet Archive, we will also be presenting movie formats as well, settling on a standard encoding format such as MPEG-2 in most cases, so that we can distribute copies naturally over the web to people who are interested in seeing Machinima movies. This has led us at Stanford to think about the technical problem of developing a player for these movies that would make it possible to view game movies in their original format without owning games like Quake or Quake 2 or whatever. It doesn't just apply to Machinima. If you want to play a Warcraft replay, you need to have Warcraft to see that. In fact, You may need to have the particular version of Warcraft that was in effect when that replay was made to see that replay. So it's not just this kind of performance, but it's also actual game demo movies and so on that require that. The collection of Machinima files will include associated metadata for descriptive, technical, and rights management information. Not all of that will be public, I guess. The Internet Archive's bandwidth and server space, while not unlimited, is certainly sufficient to make even a collection of movies such as this seem relatively modest in its demands, so we're fine there. Given our early success in convincing Machinima artists and collective sites such as Machinima.com to deposit their movies with the Machinima Archive, we decided pretty much to go for it and create additional collections for things like demo movies, speedruns, replay movies. Every time I see Simon, he's got some other collection that somebody's given along those lines. So I believe that we will have very shortly a very significant collection of replay, demo, and Machinima movies. In addition to that, these sites will become community sites, so those collections will grow. So I think we will be in pretty good shape as far as performance of games. The Machinima Archive, as I said, is a game performance collection. Work on emulation, reformatting of game software, and conservation of game artifacts is also proceeding. I'm not going to say too much about the Internet Archive stuff because Simon is here, but I do want to point out that these projects are often interlinked. For example, we have at Stanford a very large collection of game software, the Cabernetti Collection, about 25,000 titles, all in the original boxes with the manuals and so on. And we have an opportunity now to collaborate with the Internet Archive through the CLASP project on the preservation in other formats of that game software. And that may lead to creation of emulators and the possibility of playing Machinima movies in their original format later. So all of these various projects will be interlinked. Oops, that's clasped. In order legally to migrate data from copy-protected media, the Internet Archive, with some little bit of support from us at Stanford, and other institutions successfully lobbied the Copyright Office in October 2003 for a 5-year exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I wasn't sure if Simon was going to mention this, but I always try to throw this in because, at least in the United States, I've rarely run into people who knew about this. But we do have a 5-year window to do a significant amount of work in terms of reformatting, getting software off of the original media in the case of obsolete platforms. Other institutions such as the Computerspiele Museum in Berlin and the Computer History Museum Center in Mountain View, California are building collections of game-related computer hardware. The creator of the Computerspiele Museum, Andreas Lange, has also founded DIGA, the Digital Game Archive. Like the Internet Archive, DIGA is collecting commercial software with the permission of rights holders. However, it's also providing access to the software in light of the multitude of emulators available on the web that can be used to execute these files. Now, time doesn't permit description of any more archival and historical projects right now, but I'd like to mention the proposed archive of war games simulation and modeling devoted to military war games that will be starting at Stanford. Thus far, we have the Battle of 73 Easting collection there, which was recently exhibited in recently exhibited in San Francisco, and something like the Richard Bartle papers, the developer of the original MUD game, which we have at Stanford. And there I want to point out the importance of archival documentation as well as part of collections like these. Together with the other projects already mentioned, these projects address the range of goals for historical game archives: artifacts collections, original and reformatted software repositories, performance archives, and special collections of manuscripts, documentation, and game design materials. So let me conclude by saying, as we begin building the computer game archives of the future in the present, we should be guided by three notions. The first is careful revision of institutional and curatorial roles for historical new media collections. not just technical work, but there's a lot of institutional and social work, let's say, to be done. The second is to define technical foundations for repositories that will be focused less on conserving physical objects than emulating the look and feel of interactive media, documenting and delivering computer-mediated performance, describing and reformatting media objects, and possibly, this is something I didn't talk about, but possibly even recreating social and personal experiences made possible by historical media such as computer games. There's a lot to think about in the history of, let's say, massively multiplayer games, how we will try to convey that kind of experience to people. The third notion that I have is simply that the linchpin of all that follows, all that we'll do, the linchpin will be to solve these problems in collaborative, multi-institutional projects. Without the cooperation of industry groups, game designers, publishers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we cannot make progress on the sticky social, business, and legal issues that might hinder our work. Playing history with games will be a team sport. Thank you.